May it please the court, my name is Paul Logan. I'm a member of the Delaware Bar. I'm honored to be here today. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This matter comes here on an appeal from a decision by Vice Chancellor Noble, who considered a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6, an action brought by Kuhn Construction, who is the contractor building the Berth 4 for the Port of Wilmington. And the reason it got before Judge Noble in the first instance was that in March of 2008, Kuhn began to submit to the port a number of invoices which reflected its belief that it was entitled to additional compensation arising out of that project. After a period of months, 8 invoices being submitted, there was a November 11 letter sent by the executive director of the port. And that November 11 letter invited, almost mandated, that Kuhn participate in a multi-party proceeding. And that multi-party proceeding included the following: Kuhn Construction, who was the contractor, OCC, the design professional, Duffield and Associates, who was a design professional but did some specific testing of welding, and ostensibly the port as a party, where the executive director of the port would act as, quote, referee. The response by Kuhn was, no, we do not believe that you have the authority to do this under the, quote, referee clause, because it purported to be a hearing where there was a mandate that Kuhn not only participate, but also prepare expert reports and submit number of documents to the executive director as if he were.
Who is the executive director? Is it a state official or just someone who's hired by
I believe he is, he is the top person. He is the person in authority at the port. I do not know how he is appointed, but he is the top of the administrative pyramid at the port. He is one of the owner's representatives identified in the contract.
What's his name?
Eugene Bailey.
So ultimately, everyone agreed this didn't apply to multiple parties, so now we're down just to Kuhn Construction. Is that right?
That is correct. However, the way that that occurred was during argument, and this was a 12b-6, because there was a motion to compel arbitration. And that arbitration that was before Judge Noble, when it started, was this multi-party arbitration. And at the end of the dialogue, at the end of the argument, the port conceded and the court had identified the issue that, no, this contract does not allow for multi-party arbitration, if in fact that is what this clause is. The matter morphed then into a statement by the port's counsel, accepted by Vice Chancellor Noble, that, okay, then we'll just do it with Kuhn. And that then, again, G's directly into one of the major issues here is the referee clause itself something that compels arbitration, or is it, as Kuhn has believed it to be and has articulated in its papers seeking to foreclose arbitration, something that is mandated as a day-to-day type decision-making process where the executive director, who is the owner, gets to decide questions because he gets to decide what he wants ultimately at the end of the day when the port has completed.
Well, in this case, the vice chancellor concluded that he was bound by this court's holding in Ruckman.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the question is, is it your contention that Ruckman is distinguishable or that it needs to be overruled for you to prevail?
Your Honor, I believe it's distinguishable. I don't believe it needs to be overruled. And the reason is that Ruckman has an appropriate place in the history of Delaware jurisprudence. Ruckman was decided after a previous decision of this court known as Wilson, because Ruckman cites the Wilson as the authority from whence it gathered its momentum to say that once the parties have gone through the process, they are bound by that process. And yes, Ruckman did say that a very similar clause sounded like or was an arbitration clause.
Well, it's almost identical.
It is, Your Honor, it is. But what happened, that occurred before the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act was adopted. In 1972, the General Assembly adopted the Delaware Arbitration Act, and in so doing, then codified the rules, because in the day and age of Ruckman and Wilson, the rule of law was that one could participate in an arbitration up to almost the very end, until there was actually a decision rendered, and say, I choose not to do this any further, and go to court. That was the rule of law. There is a case that it did not make it into our brief. It is an unreported case, but nevertheless meets the criteria. It is a case called Massetti, 1982, Delaware Chancery, Lexis 447, that actually states fairly well the history of common law arbitration in Delaware, then the transition into the 1972 era of it's now codified.
Well, it is this, now. This case is not cited in the brief?
It was not cited in your brief, Your Honor, and I apologize.
So none of us but you know.
I alerted counsel yesterday. It is because it does not shepherdize into, when you shepherdize, frankly, the Ruckman case, it doesn't show up. And frankly, what I did was a word search just to make sure, and there it is.
Did you alert the court yesterday?
I did not alert the court yesterday. I did alert counsel.
Well, in Ruckman, did the parties agree that they were bound by arbitration but disagreed whether the proper subject matter was present to be arbitrated?
I don't believe Ruckman specifically identifies whether the parties agreed or didn't agree. What happened in Ruckman is that after the decision was rendered, one of the parties was unhappy and said that one of the issues was not subject to the review of the arbitrator in Ruckman.
Right. And well, that was my question.
Yes.
The holding in Ruckman was not that this language or language similar to it constituted binding arbitration. The dispute was over whether certain subject matter could be arbitrated under that language, correct?
Yes, that is precisely correct.
Why then did Vice Chancellor Noble believe he was bound by Ruckman to conclude that this language constituted an agreement to bind the arbitration?
Your Honor, I believe that Vice Chancellor Noble read a provision. Actually, the words out of Ruckman do say that the referee clause is an arbitration clause.
He also relied on a subsequent decision by Vice Chancellor Hartnett, didn't he?
I do not believe that he did. I think he cited to Vice Chancellor Hartnett's decision. I think that's the Gaunt matter, where
Vice Chancellor Hartnett, then Vice Chancellor Hartnett, had the same reservations I do.
Yes.
Nevertheless, he followed Ruckman, and I'm going to follow Ruckman.
I think Vice Chancellor, what in the Gaunt matter, and that is Vice Chancellor Hartnett's case, what was then at issue was there was a case in New Jersey and a case in Delaware over the same subject matter. And there was a motion for summary judgment before Vice Chancellor Hartnett at the time. And there was actually competing courts over what was to be decided. What Vice Chancellor Hartnett said was that as a matter of law, he would not conclude that that referee clause was an arbitration clause. That's what he said, and it was, and it appears to be the reason for his decision of denying the motion for summary judgment. He had the reservation, but did in fact refer to Ruckman, but had and made it plain that the reason he was not then willing to grant summary judgment based upon the claim that there was an arbitration clause was that he did not necessarily believe that it was. So that was what Vice Chancellor Noble, when he pointed to the Gaunt matter, was agreeing that there is some question. Vice Chancellor Noble underscored the fact that he even said that he might reach a different decision. He never got there, of course, if Ruckman was not binding upon him. As he read it,
I understand your argument is your argument that Ruckman doesn't stand for the proposition relied on by your opponent, or is it that Ruckman was somehow modified by the subsequent statutory enactment, or both?
It's a bit of both. It is that Ruckman, taken in its historical context of the jurisprudence of arbitration in this state, had its place and its time. The one in passing comment of this referee clause is an arbitration clause does not stick or hold and mandate that it is for all times an arbitration clause. Because later, as cases became more focused after the Arbitration Act was adopted, the underscoring, since before parties could essentially call it off and say, I don't want to do the arbitration, the policy shifted to say, if you agree to it, you're bound by it. From the beginning, you have no way to stop. And when what the jurisprudence post that, the adoption of the Arbitration Act was, that, and it was, in fact, Justice Howland that wrote in DMS Properties that there has to be a clear intent to arbitrate. That's the underscored clear intent to arbitrate. What Vice Chancellor Noble said in his decision was that, first of all, the language could have been clearer. And in fact, he then went further to say that by including arbitration in the original documents and then striking them was suggestive of the fact that arbitration was not to be the means to resolve these matters. I believe then that Vice Chancellor Noble had the absolute right at that point in time to say, I hereby find, based on the language before me, there was no clear intent to arbitrate. Certainly, Kuhn did not, and has taken the position that it never acceded to, having the executive director decide all matters that would affect ultimately its financial well-being in this case. And in point of fact,
are you contending that the clause is structurally unfair?
I am stating that, yes, it is structurally unfair as applied in this particular case. And I can point to a statement made during the argument before Vice Chancellor Noble. It is in the record at page A451, where the colloquy was between Vice Chancellor Noble and my colleague, Mr. Reed, where Vice Chancellor said, so this is really where the director is going to sit back and say there is no owner risk here. It's either contractor risk or A&E risk, which was the three-party, the multi-party. And the answer by Mr. Reed was, correct. The court, that's the dynamic, Mr. Reed, yes, Your Honor. So that even in the context of the general notion in construction, the construction industry, and even in the law, it appears from that colloquy that case is over, the port is already exonerated, and the claims actually are regarding the claims made by Kuhn against the port itself. It has no right contractually to go after the other parties because they're not a part of the contract. They can't go and sue under the contract, Duffield or OCC directly.
So let me have your view on what appears to be the party's position. You've just said that by striking out the elaborate arbitration clause, arbitration as a concept was out. Your opponent is saying while they did strike out the elaborate arbitration, they left in the referee clause, which is a form of arbitration under Ruckman, and that's where we are. Your position is no, the referee clause really isn't arbitration. It's a way that you deal with these minor things that arise.
That would be correct, Your Honor. And to make that, underscore that a bit, is that not only did jurisprudence change over time, but also the construction industry transpired over time. And in fact, the word arbitration has a special meaning. And with all due respect to Mr. Reed, some of the answers that he gave to Vice Chancellor Noble were incorrect as to the status of the construction industry. For example, currently the DelDOT, the Delaware Department of Transportation, does arbitration and says so.
What's the significance in your view of the 1968 case involving Kuhn Construction?
Your Honor, that case has limited, it talks again to parties who had an understanding and went forward. It is an artifact of the jurisprudence that went forward. It is not what I believe is, as suggested by the port, that Kuhn should have known better, because that wasn't, again, the issue before it. I see that my time is now up for 5 minutes of reserved rebuttal, if I may, if the court doesn't have any questions at this time. I would like the rebuttal time.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Donald Reed. I'm here on behalf of the Diamond State Port Corporation, which I will refer to as DSPC. The Court of Chancery correctly granted DSPC's motion to compel arbitration in this case based on the party's contract and on established Delaware law. As your honors have seen, the contract in this case contains a provision which states in part that, and I quote, the director shall act as referee in all questions arising under the terms of the contract, and the decision of the director shall be final and binding. It then goes on to further clarify that, and again I quote, all questions concerning interpretation of plans and specifications, the acceptability, quality, quantity of materials or machinery furnished, work performed, and the determination of payment due or to become due shall be decided by the director, and his decision shall be final and binding, end quote. That's in section 7.21 of the special conditions of the contract. That is a simple, straightforward arbitration clause.
Now, if I understand the inclusiveness of that language to be as broad as it appears to be on its face, is Article 3 surplusage?
No, Your Honor. As Vice Chancellor Noble pointed out, and we're here today because there are always things that have to be decided by the courts, even where you have an arbitration clause. So it is not surplusage at all. You had to have a provision like this in case there was an issue about whether the arbitration could be compelled or following arbitration, whether it could be enforced. So it's not surplusage.
But no substantive issue under the contract itself would be subject to a court review.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's what the parties intended when they entered into this language, you believe?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why the use of the term referee rather than arbitrator? Does that have some special significance?
No, Your Honor. It's a historical artifact, and I'm going just based on my own knowledge and memory of the time period. I know that this clause was used by the Delaware River and Bay Authority for many years, as you've seen from the cases. And it was adopted by the Diamond State Port Corporation directly from the Delaware State Port Corporation.
But it's not a defined term of the contract.
It is not, Your Honor, no. But I think if you look, you'll see other cases that also use referee, and it's another term for arbitrator.
Now, referee has a sense to me of someone who is overseeing the direction of the game, but once the game is over, the referee has no role. So if there's a dispute about the outcome of the game, the referee is not involved in that. Is that a different sense of referee here?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I think if you, in fact, look at a dictionary definition of referee, you will find it refers to an arbitrator as another definition of referee.
Maybe I better pick up the dictionary.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a structural unfairness issue here? I mean, if two sports teams are playing basketball and one team says our captain will be the referee and decide whether there's fouls or not, I mean, does that create a structural unfairness issue?
No.
Does that matter?
It does not, Your Honor. If, in fact, after the game started or after the contract was entered into, someone said that was going to be the case, then an argument could be made that that's unfair. That is not the situation here. In this case, going into the contract, the parties knew and agreed who the arbitrator was going to be, the executive director. It's in the contract, which they signed at the time. So they knew it ahead of time.
But under its application, the executive director is basically saying, my employer either owes additional money or does not. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. And this court has, in fact, said on at least two occasions, I believe, that is not improper or unfair. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, as long as the parties know it ahead of time going into the contract. I would note that, in fact, under established Delaware.
Just procedurally, could this term be was this term negotiated, or is it sort of this is the way it is?
Well, it actually is something that could have been negotiated, Your Honor. The process of the contract is there's a pre-bid meeting for all the people that bid on these contracts. They can come in and ask questions, try and establish if there's things that need to be changed, if there's issues. It could have been negotiated. In fact, you'll see in the record there are two other parties that have been mentioned, Ocean Consultants, let me get the right name right, Ocean and Coastal Consultants was the engineer, OCC. They signed a contract, separate contract with the port, which has this very same language in it, which was not changed. Duffield, an engineer, did certain construction review services. They signed a separate contract with the port, which has this language, but they negotiated it, and they added additional language to it.
What's the background in the record for the deletion of the specific arbitration clause?
Well, there's no background other than the document itself, of course, Your Honor, but I think it's apparent that it was necessary to delete that provision because otherwise you'd have a conflict between Section 7.2 and that provision. You'd have essentially two arbitration provisions.
Did Kuhn Construction have any input on that deletion?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they did as it was originally drafted. They certainly had the opportunity to ask that there be a revision to it.
Is that before they made a bid or after they were the successful bidder?
It would have been, pre-bid. They could have asked questions about it. What's the intent of this contract, of this clause? Can the referee be changed? Can we do something different? Can we have arbitration under the construction industry rules or the AAA rules?
So in response to Justice Ridgely's question about whether this was really a contract of adhesion, your response is, it really isn't a contract of adhesion. It's simply one of the conditions of the bid. And you know when you bid, if there's a dispute, our executive director is going to be the referee. And if that concerns you, don't bid. But if you bid, you're accepting that condition.
Don't bid or come to the pre-bid meeting and ask if it can be changed. That's another option, which is effectively what Duffield did. They changed it. They changed the provision. So it is something that could have been negotiated.
So to that extent, the Duffield bid was not subject to a condition that Kuhn was because they didn't ask for the same change Duffield asked for.
Correct.
And Duffield asked for that change pre-bid?
All I can cite you to, Your Honor, is the contract with Duffield. I don't have personal knowledge of exactly the sequence of events with Duffield, but the Duffield contract has the same language, and then below it there's additional language which was added by Duffield, and another provision below that was struck out by Duffield with initials added to it.
Can't there be issues created by changing this after the bid, among other bidders saying, I didn't bid because that language was in there, and now you've changed the rules? Or I would have had a different bid if...
Absolutely. There's that potential, Your Honor. That's why I say it's the pre-bid meeting would have been the crucial time to raise this when all the bidders would have been present and could have had the same input into the issue. Okay. You know, as I pointed out, Your Honor, Delaware case law, the Wilson case, for example, the Superior Court noted that it is not improper, and I quote, even though a referee or arbitrator is within the employ of one of the parties, as this fact was clearly known at the time of the selection, the parties are bound by their agreement, end quote. On appeal to this court, the court affirmed and again said, and I'm quoting, there's nothing inherently wrong legally with a provision naming a referee to resolve disputes between the parties, even though the referee be a person employed by one of them.
Do you believe for us to rule in favor of the appellant, if we were to do that, that we have to overrule Ruckman?
Yes, Your Honor, you would. Because the Ruckman case essentially decided that the provision, which is identical to the provision in this case, is an arbitration clause. Now, counsel is right, Counselor Kuhn is correct, that the Delaware Arbitration Act had not yet been passed, so it's a slightly different procedural context in Ruckman. But that has no impact today because today the Arbitration Act has been passed and does exist. So at the time this contract was signed, That arbitration clause, which under Ruckman was viewed as an arbitration clause, is a binding enforceable agreement under the Arbitration Act.
In Ruckman, did the parties contest whether the language was a binding arbitration clause?
All we have, Your Honor, is the decision. I don't have the briefs of the parties to know exactly what they contended.
But from the decision itself, does it seem obvious that that was not a contested point, that the contested point was whether or not the subject matter under dispute was subject to arbitration?
I do agree with Your Honor that the principal argument made in that case was that the claims that were trying to be asserted in court were outside the scope of the clause.
Now, when you say the principal argument, are you leaving wiggle room for the argument that someone said this was not an arbitration clause, someone else said it was, and then the court held that it was?
I'm leaving wiggle room because I just don't remember specifically all the language in the case as to exactly what was contended by the parties. But my point is that even though they said we believe it's outside the scope of the clause, the court said no, this is an all-inclusive arbitration clause, and the claims you're trying to assert had to be arbitrated.
Well, if the parties had taken the position it wasn't an arbitration clause, you would assume the court would have addressed that, because if the court agreed with that position, that would have been the end of the case, and you wouldn't have had to decide if it was within the purview of an arbitration clause if the clause didn't apply to arbitration at all.
That may well be valid, Your Honor. I would agree with you.
And the reason those questions are asked, I suspect, is to explore whether or not we would need to overrule Ruckman if we were to rule in favor of the appellate. Would we, if that were not the fundamental holding of Ruckman?
It's possible Your Honor could conclude that, in fact, there was not a specific holding, and therefore it wouldn't have to be explicitly overruled. But the fact remains that the court addressed the clause and dealt with it as an arbitration clause. So I think effectively you would have to overrule it. Your Honors, we believe that the clause in this case is a simple, direct arbitration clause that was enforceable and was properly enforced by the Court of Chancery. Unless Your Honors have further questions, I have nothing further to add.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, there were several points that were raised, and let me start with the last. No, the court does not need to overrule Ruckman in order to decide in favor of the appellant. It was not decided that this was an arbitration clause. It was a foregone conclusion that it was, and the issue there was whether or not the issue that was then before the court was within or without that arbitration clause. It was foregone conclusion.
What does that mean? It was a foregone conclusion by the parties, or it was a foregone conclusion by the court after it read the clause? If the court and the parties all agree it's an arbitration clause, then the court went to the merits of whether it was within or without arbitration. But to tell us now that the court and the parties proceeded on an incorrect assumption, is that what you're saying?
I'm not suggesting that at all, Your Honor. I am suggesting that what the court based a decision, the Ruckman decision, on was that everyone believed it to be an arbitration clause. That does not appear from the decision itself to have been a contested issue either by the parties, and the court accepted it as such, stated it as such, and then decided whether or not the controversy before it fell within or outside of that clause. And that's what Ruckman decided. And again, it pointed back to Wilson, which where it got its horsepower, if you will. But Wilson didn't decide that that clause was an arbitration clause either. That was a Delaware Department of Highways case. That, again, was a case that said if you go through arbitration, you're bound by the outcome. You had a chance, but you went past it. Now it's final. Don't come back and ask us to review it now. Let me just address one.
Let me ask you one question before you do. Do you agree with Mr. Reed about the application of Article 3, that even if this referee language constitutes arbitration of the, all-inclusive issues, as it appears to wish to cover, what's left for Article 3?
Article 3 cannot stand simply as a choice of venue. It has some meaning because all clauses in a contract, first of all, we start out with the premise that it's there for a reason. It's not just redundant. It's just not a throwaway. And it talks about the jurisdiction of the courts on all matters. And if there was only one venue to decide, and I heard Mr. Reed say, though, well, there are a lot of other things that could be decided, I can't think of one, and I tried to.
He says the one we have right now.
Well, the arbitration, but that goes directly to the Arbitration Act that says that the Court of Chancery is where you go. This says the courts, and it even says United States District Court in Delaware. So that, yes, arbitration matters, if there were any, would go to the Court of Chancery. If they meant to say Court of Chancery because all we have is arbitration, they could have said that. They didn't, though. Well, they are the drafters of this contract.
This language doesn't answer a typical question that we see, which is whether or not subject matter is subject to arbitration or not. Under this language, would the referee decide what was and what was not subject to arbitration?
It is unclear whether or not there are any bounds to what the referee should decide. Kuhn believes that this is a day-to-day decision-making process. And the reason I can point to that
What's an example of the decisions that it would cover?
Your Honor, for example, there are certain things called bollards, things that sit out there that you can tie ships to or prevent traffic going from. If there is a question that port says, I think there's three of them, or I think there are red ones, and Kuhn says, no, I think there's four of them, and I think there are blue ones, the referee, who is the ultimate owner, who knows what he wants, would say, I want two of them, and I want orange ones. That's what the referee gets to decide in those day-to-day tensions between that can come up from somebody's got to make a decision.
Well, let's go with that analogy. And Kuhn says, okay, well, if you want three of them, that's one more than we bargained for. You owe us for the extra one. Is that something the referee would say, well, no, we're not paying you for the extra one. You should have bid for three. We need three, or not?
Your Honor, that points out the referee decides questions. If the port says, I want three and give me three, there are no questions and the referee doesn't intervene. But the question following that is, do they get paid or don't they? That's where we are in this controversy. The port already said in response to all of the eight invoices, no, I'm not paying you. No, I'm not paying you. No, I'm not paying you. But literally, with no provocation, with no one asking, port, to our knowledge, didn't ask the executive director. We certainly didn't. The executive director, on his own, on November 11, said, I wish to conduct this proceeding with all of these people here. There was no question. There was nothing there. I see that my time is up.
I have one last question. Does the record reflect who signed the rejection on behalf of the port? Was it someone other than the executive director?
The rejection?
They said, we're not paying you.
I don't recall the record clearly. I can make a representation to the court with absolute knowledge that it was not the executive director, that there was in the contract named another person who is the owner's representative, who also can make decisions and determinations, and it was that individual who received the invoices and almost by return sent him back saying, no, we're not paying.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.